College football nerds, and we are talking that epic win for Texas A&M over Alabama in Aggieland. And we tried, or I tried, to have Josh let me do in our live show last night a review of this game that we could cut up, and y'all voted and said you wanted to hear a top 10. So here we are getting the thing that I wanted to do in, which is also my way of reminding y'all that we do a live show every Saturday. You can go back and watch it on our YouTube channel, or you can check it out on the podcast version because it's like 2.5 hours long. We started at halftime last night of the Alabama A&M game, went all the way through, talked after it was over. A lot of fun that we discuss in the moment and talk about stuff that happened throughout the day. Just a reminder, check it out. Links are in the description. Anyway, also got a little homework for y'all. In the comments, let us know what you think the key factor was in this game that really turned it for A&M in the win. And I want to start, Josh, because, you know, given that Alabama's been this Death Star domination thing, our tendency and everybody's tendency is going to be to gravitate towards what went wrong for Alabama, or let's dissect where Alabama screwed up in this game. But I think it's only fair to note two things. One, we're here reviewing a game that we picked way wrong. We picked Alabama to cover the spread, win this big, and we want to, you know, eat some crow on that and give A&M their due that you won the game, we picked it wrong, and we're here to talk about it. But two, let's give A&M some props before we get into all of what went wrong for Alabama. And I want to start, or want you to start, Josh, and we're going to do this in a matchups kind of way, because that's where things, you know, play out, is matchups. I want you to start with the line play. We started talking about this coming out of the halftime, saying the difference in the game right now is both lines of scrimmage. Got a little bit better for Alabama in the second half, but overall, let's get into the line play for both teams and how this was great for A&M.
The number one factor in this game really was the offensive line versus the defensive line on both sides. A lot of people are going to nitpick quarterback play, drop passes, tackles, all this other stuff. But the truth of the matter is everything on this game hinged off the offensive lines versus the defensive lines. And Texas A&M in this game came in with a defensive line that had not met any of the preseason expectations. I think a lot of people have forgotten that Texas A&M was thought to have one of the very best, if not maybe even the best, defensive line in the country coming into the season. I mean, they're right up there with Ohio State. The recruiting rankings for their defensive line are insane. Production from Leal, you got guys like McKinley Jackson, all really, really good players, all the way down the depth chart. And we just really hadn't seen it. And then on the offensive line, Texas A&M had struggled tremendously through the year. Now, they've had a lot of injuries. They've been juggling starters. But it's not just been a one-on-one matchup thing. They had been having issues consistently making their assignments, not giving up free rushers, etc. All those concerns and problems disappeared. Texas A&M's defensive line looked like the dominant unit they were expected to be all the season. They had a high motor. They were continually generating pass rush. They were continually giving Alabama problems. The thing that really shocked me was that Texas A&M's offensive line won their matchups. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, like they make a shift and they put Green at tackle and they bring another guy in at guard and they've got multiple true freshmen. If maybe those young players they've brought in have kind of inadvertently fixed some problems. I mean, maybe these young players are better than the guys that had been in before. And then the rest of them have sort of figured things out. But that offensive line was more than competent. I mean, they moved the ball pretty well. They didn't give up a ton of pressures. They didn't give up a lot of negative plays. And, you know, let's be realistic. It's not as though Texas A&M dominated Alabama with Texas A&M's offensive line. I mean, they were – key here is they were effective enough, right? I mean, Spiller went for 2.7 yards per carry in the game. As much as it felt like he was being really effective, he was 46 yards on 17 carries. A-Chain was a little more successful, but he was only 4.9 yards per carry. The trick is those numbers are still decent. They were still moving the ball. And importantly, Calzada had a lot of time to throw when they did choose to throw, and they did a really good job of picking up Alabama's blitz packages that gave Calzada time. Now, you know, I think the other side, if we're talking about the positive for Texas A&M, do you mind if I talk about a little bit the negative for Alabama?
No, go right ahead.
The problem for Alabama was their offensive line was a train wreck. And I think we'd seen at times this season indications that their offensive line and defensive lines were shaky. Now, their defensive line hasn't been dominant for a few years. We talked about this dating back to 2019. They got really beat up on the defensive line that year, and at the end of the year when they lost to Auburn, it was in part because guys like Barmore weren't available. And when they were playing like freshmen, I think it was like Ebu Igbe and a lot of the guys, Dale was maybe hobbled, maybe I think he might have been in that game. Guys that are starting now for Alabama were the freshmen at the time that got run over by an Auburn team that couldn't get 3 yards per carry against Minnesota in the bowl. Really hadn't moved the ball at all year. Those guys have grown up and they've gotten better, but I don't know that they've gotten great. And Alabama, for whatever reason, has failed to find or replace them with elite guys. It's really obvious now Christian Barmore was the one dominant player on the defensive line rotation from last year. I know Tim Smith made a couple plays, but a lot of, when you watch them, even their guys like Smith, who occasionally gets disruption, I've seen Young get disruption, they also get single blocked and blown out of the play on a lot of run plays. And the problem with their defensive line is if you don't see them making a play, there's a very good chance they're on skates. And even the guys you see that make plays for them, those guys are the worst offenders about not being in their gap and about getting blown out. And so when you don't notice them, they're probably playing really poorly. And there's a lot of blame on Alabama's inside linebackers, and they're not playing well. And you'll probably have your own thoughts on that. But I want people to understand how badly their defensive line got beaten and abused at times by A&M's front. And when that happens, the O-linemen get to the second level, and a 230-pound linebacker is never going to play worth a flip if he's actually blocked one-on-one by a 310-pound guard. It does not happen. They are not supposed to have those players in their face. And I wonder how much you can blame the scheme, having two outside linebackers, one of which was a true freshman due to a starter and a backup being out hurt. But Alabama's defensive line really struggled, and their O-line, which is a new unit, Evan Neal is the key centerpiece at left tackle, clearly doesn't have a high-end right tackle. I don't think they have one in the roster. They don't have a Jonah Williams stepping up. And the rest of the guys, particularly number 70, the left guard, struggled. It's a really bad case of poor play, poor execution, and not a whole lot of experienced talent they can rely on both units for Alabama.
And I think some of that, like, Alabama fans are going to maximize all the things that their offensive line or defensive line did wrong. But I'm going to turn around and say, well, you scored 31 offensive points. Let's not count the seven on either side for special teams. You scored 31 offensive points. You had a couple of drives where you could have scored even more. So their offensive line did get wins. What was surprising to me, and this is where I'll give Elko a lot of credit, I think they saw something on tape. We remember the two really where Owens got beaten really bad on the outside. We remember those two plays, but we don't remember that what I think was giving them more trouble was what I think Elko saw on tape, overloading and running up just straight up the middle. And that's where we got a lot of the free rush. We saw a lot of the free rush situation. And that's credit to their being able, A&M's being able to scheme ahead of time something that maybe they saw on film and leaning into it until Alabama stopped it. Now, they stopped it in the second half, but it took them 2.5 quarters to really adjust to it. And by that point, they were digging themselves out of too much of a hole. Same thing on the defensive side of the ball. Alabama adjusted eventually, but it was too late. I mean, they did a good job in the second half defensively, if you think about it, but it was too little too late. And that, to me, is a credit on one side to the A&M coaching staff and a concern on the other for the Alabama coaching staff. And, you know, I want to get into quarterback play in a minute, Josh. I think that is something that, you know, you've got some concerns with Bryce Young and some accolades for Calzada. But before we get into that, I've got this thing that I've been saying now for a little bit this year, and this is why I moved Alabama after the Florida game. Down to number two. I've got some concerns when I see a Kentucky be able to stonewall Florida, when I see, you know, an Arkansas be able to stonewall Texas A&M. At what point do Alabama fans who want to fire Pete Golding have sort of an argument because they're saying we're five-star city on the defensive side of the ball and we're struggling way more than an Arkansas or a Kentucky who consistently can do good things against defenses that we struggle with? At what point is there an indictment or concern for this Alabama coaching staff?
I think the concern for the Alabama coaching staff is that you've gotten a tremendous amount of talent to work with, and you're not managing to produce with it. I mean, Alabama's defense is senior laden. There's really no excuse for them not to be an really reactive, high-tackling, high-caliber defense. And I don't think there's any explanation for it other than the turnover they've had at the defensive coordinator position and lack of development. It's funny because I got curious about this and looked at it before we did the preview, because we talked at length about A&M and our live show and that game and what happened. And I was trying to figure out where did they kind of go off the rails. And I've heard a lot of Alabama fans talk about Jeremy Pruitt, who, you know, went to Tennessee and they saw him as the salvation because he had Reggie Ragland, Reuben Foster, great linebacking corps. But when I went back and looked at it and who recruited whom, Jeremy Pruitt's linebacker recruits were Adonis Thomas, who I believe ended up at Florida State, Josh McMillan, who never started and then got hurt his senior year when he was going to have to play, Ben Davis, who transferred to Texas and never played for Alabama, Mack Wilson, who never really played but never really reached his potential and went pro early, Dylan Moses, who looked like he was going to be the good player of the group, but never panned out, like hadn't fully panned out, became draft eligible, tore up his knee, missed a year. When he came back, he wasn't the same. I don't know what he would have been. And then Vandarius Cowan, who was, I think, kicked off the team. Markell Benton, who I know he was the guy in that LSU game that was really terrible. We never saw him again. All the linebackers Jeremy Pruitt recruited for Alabama were bad, pretty much. Or a couple of them were able to contribute. Most of them were completely non-contributors. And they, I think they created this hole for themselves. And, you know, they had a transition where they had Tosh Lapoy, who I don't think did a very good job in recruiting or development in his 1 year as a defensive coordinator. And all of a sudden, now you have Pete Golding, who had to start two true freshmen at inside linebacker. I don't think they've done a good job developing the guys they had under Golding. But I also have to recognize the fact that their talent level when he inherited that team was just so much lower than it should have been. And it's made it really difficult to evaluate him. I think they filled needs. I mean, when you look at the depth chart, and I started looking at guys like Lawson and Kennedy, and there's Blackshire, there are these guys in the recruiting roster from the past few years that are highly rated talents. Haven't seen them play, don't know how good they are, but there's promise there for them to fix their problems. But I think Golding has been a really good coordinator in theory. I think schematically, he's really good in theory. His recruiting has patched holes where Pruitt took a lot of project guys that had problems, didn't pan out. A lot of the five stars, Ben Davis was a total bust. Golding was able to get guys that were, you know, maybe have some potential, but he hasn't developed it. And I will say, if they let Golding go, I think whoever inherits the talent is going to look phenomenal. And this goes back to a point I make a lot. If you have a bad coach or a bad developing coach, especially one that recruits well, and they have a bad year, like Chizik in 2012, when you replace him, the next guy tends to look like a genius because he gets a tremendous amount of talent that is sitting there waiting for somebody to make them work, and you go from underutilized to motivated and utilized well. And I'll add one point there. The startling thing when I went through this and looked at who recruited who and who coached who, you know who coached those linebackers that Jeremy Pruitt really excelled with when he was there for a couple years at Alabama? You know who recruited and coached Reuben Foster and Reggie Ragland? Kirby Smart. So Alabama fans don't want to hear it, but you know, there may be a real reality here that Kirby Smart really was a big part of why their linebackers were so successful. Pruitt coached them well, but he didn't recruit well, he didn't develop well at all, and he left a hole. They've had very young coordinators since then, and I don't think they have the attitude and mindset needed. And it feels like it's gotten worse every year there. They're not the same caliber defense. And I think we can kind of end it there for ragging on Alabama a little bit and turn it back to A&M. But that's the takeaway I want you to have from that segment, is just Alabama's got talent. They should be a lot better than this. They're in a well-positioned to do well, especially in future years. But at this point, you have to question whether this staff was really good at figuring out what pieces they needed, getting those pieces in the program, and has not been able to do anything with them.
Well, my point really, though, is like, regardless of what Golding inherited, I imagine it's better than Kentucky. right? Like than what Kentucky was able to get. But Kentucky might have a better defense than Alabama because Kentucky has developed that lesser talent to a better, you know, ability. Now, I think Alabama's also gone a little bit more specialized in wanting to stop Ole Miss because they see that as the overarching threat, and they did that a lot better than Arkansas. Just going to get that out there. But, yeah, you make a good point. Let's bring it back to A&M. And I'll say this by saying a lot of Alabama fans are mad at Bryce Young. I thought he did as well as could be expected. But on the flip side, we got so much more out of Calzada than anybody expected. I will say a lot of it has to do with the line play. But let's not forget when the game's on the line, he's got the one time where he does have rushers in his face. He's throwing a wheel and dropping it in the bucket with all the pressure in the world on him. That was all Calzada. That was not, you know, offensive line or Alabama not getting home. Alabama got home. Calzada read the hot read, drops it in good coverage. So not only did Alabama get home, they also covered well, and he still dropped a dime on him. And he had a couple of plays like that where he really reacted quickly. It looked like the game had slowed down for him that we haven't seen yet. So, Josh, noting all of this, are we to take away a lot of optimism for A&M going forward? Or is it that Alabama is a lot worse than we all thought and we still need to be scared if we're expecting or hoping A&M to put together a really good season this year?
Going into the season, Texas A&M, and I'm looking at Athlon's rankings right now, supposed to be third in the SEC in running back, supposed to be third in the SEC at the offensive line, third in the SEC in the D-line, third in the SEC at defensive back. This was a team that was picked almost across the board as a top 10 team. The two question marks were quarterback and linebacker. To this part of the year, the offensive line had been a serious weakness. Now, again, we've already covered the injury situation, but there was every reason to believe that Texas A&M can be a very high-end unit, particularly at the defensive line, particularly as they get healthier on defense and if they get any healthier on the offensive line. I do wonder how much A&M may improve if Calzada starts to play well. Even in that Arkansas game where they, you know, looked like they were getting blown out early, and it only ended 20-10, right? And we've talked about that a lot. KJ Jefferson, quote, unquote, went off, but he had 14 yards per attempt only on 15 attempts. Traylon Smith was 4.8 yards a carry in that game. Wasn't really crazy. And I think outside a handful of blown plays, A&M really contained Arkansas defensively. The problem was that Calzada threw 150 yards on 36 attempts, 4.2 yards per attempt. Spiller went for 8 yards a carry. A-Chain went for 4.8 yards a carry. And if Calzada had gone for 8 to 9 yards an attempt, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind A&M can score more than 20 points in that game. So I do think there's a real question here. If the quarterback play is improved, if the defensive line is playing up to its standard, if they're actually generating a pass rush, if they're actually being a productive unit, I think the sky is the limit almost for Texas A&M. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, they may finish like 9-3 now. They're probably going to be ranked. I don't think 10-2 is off the table. I don't think an 11-win season is off the table for them. They may well run the table with Missouri, South Carolina, Auburn, Prairie View, LSU. Those are all very winnable games. It feels like only the Ole Miss game is in question, and I think this defensive line can give Ole Miss some serious fits. So I think, yeah, the future is really bright for Texas A&M, and if they've gotten a lot of their, you know, sort of woes under control, and you know they get guys like McKinley Jackson back as a viable part of the roster. He's had his issues. O'Neal and a lot of the guys that have been on or off, you know, at least in my view, in terms of their productivity, are now being the productivity that we were hoping they might be. You know, O'Neal is being the player that you hoped he could possibly be. Leal is the player that you hoped he might be coming into the year. They could be a really dangerous, really effective team. And as much as I do think Alabama hasn't played well, I think you also have to recognize that A&M is a high-level team capable of high-level play and has a bright future ahead of them.
And the thing that I don't want to do is overreact and give A&M too much credit if Alabama is this flawed team that we maybe think they are. Because we do tend to overreact to people playing Alabama well or beating Alabama because it happens so rarely. And now I'm not saying that A&M can't run the table. They certainly can, especially given how flawed Ole Miss is defensively. But I do want to caution that a lot of times we see a backup quarterback or a quarterback come in with nothing to lose and throw fireballs against Alabama because they feel like they've already lost. Everybody plays a little bit above their head. There's a lot of tape on what they did successfully. And then the next team they play kind of cleans it up against them and they beat them. And a year, a remaining schedule, back half of a schedule that includes a bunch of name programs who recruit really well but aren't playing up to their standard doesn't mean that they can't stub their toe. I think A&M probably loses one more game this year, which would give them a 10-win season because I think they would be underranked going into their bowl game. So that would be my guess if I were projecting out. And that is way better, Josh, than we were thinking coming out of the Mississippi State game. And almost all of it has to do with the offensive line and the quarterback play. Would you say that we're, you know, all of this is like almost a 180 based on what we were looking at coming out of the Mississippi State game?
It is. And I alluded to it, and let's be real, okay? And you can probably hear me clicking. Texas A&M's passing stats were hamstringing them to an incredible degree. Colorado, 4.8 yards per attempt. Arkansas, 4.2 yards per attempt. Mississippi State, 6.8 yards per attempt. Alabama, 9.2 yards per attempt, 3 touchdowns. Calzada did not have 3 touchdowns in the season outside of the New Mexico game against a horribly overmatched opponent. And I don't know if he plays up to that standard and how much of it's Alabama, but that was a guy that when he got thrown into the fire, he could not score against air. I mean, he could not move the ball on a really bad Colorado defense and a really bad Colorado team against a really outmatched opponent. And now all of a sudden, I saw him drive the ball really well. And if they get just above average quarterback play, that's going to be a difficult team. If they actually get good quarterback play out of him, if he gets out of a funk and plays at a high level, it is a completely, totally different team with a completely, totally different set of expectations because the defense already was good. And like you, something you say a lot, right? When a defense knows that your offense can't score, at a certain point, they just get dispirited and they start to fall apart. When the defense knows the offense is capable of scoring and that they're in games, things change and that attitude changes. And it really has a major shift in the trajectory of your program.
One other thing I want to add that I think was hugely impactful in this game, and I hope for people that made it this far into the video, the crowd deserves a lot of credit. We've seen Alabama struggle now twice with a loud environment, and they were hugely impactful in this game. I think it led to a lot of the communication issues on defense, so they deserve credit there. Josh, I'm just excited that I was worried that our multi-year sort of span of stumping for A&M being better than they were getting credit for, I was worried that it was going to have to end this season, but it looks like it's not. Give me one parting shot on both Alabama and A&M's outlook from here on out. Give me a 60-second parting shot on that.
Alabama's outlook here on out, I think, is going to depend upon their ability to get consistency and quality from the wide receiver and quarterback positions. At wide receiver, they dropped a lot of passes, but the biggest thing is they don't have hardly any explosiveness. I mean, when you look at their three receivers, I'm not sure if Mechie was a 4-star or 3-star. Bolden, I think, was maybe a 3-star. But those are basically 2 3-stars and then a transfer. They don't have 5-stars, and they've got to find them. And they can't have Bryce Young throwing the ball in the dirt because if you combine drop passes with missed throws, a lot of throws were not in the right position, things fall apart really quickly. They've got to fix those problems. They got to find a deep ball. If they can do those things, and I think they will find a way to improve, they could be better. I think you're going to see Alabama try new receivers. I think you're going to see whatever funk Young is in will start to turn around, and that offense will come around somewhere around November. Given their schedule, I think, you know, it's realistic to think they can beat Mississippi State and Tennessee and LSU, and so it really comes down to the Arkansas game. I think that they'll probably have it turned around by that point. They can be efficient enough to beat Arkansas, beat Auburn, and I think they're back in the SEC title. For A&M, I don't know, but I will say everything I said before, There's every reason to think that they have the ability to turn it around, and I think Calzada is going to give them at least average to above average QB play. Given where they're at this year, I think this is going to become a 9 or 10 win season, and it's going to come down to the Ole Miss game. They should win every other game on the schedule. LSU, I think, is a dangerous matchup for them, but they're not a good team and they're imploding. Outside that, they should be able to handle everyone else, and it's really just if they can handle Ole Miss's passing game. So it's kind of funny, right? Because we talk about Alabama. This is my parting shot, if you really want my parting shot. We talk about Alabama breaking their streak of losses to unranked teams. But the funny thing is, if A&M beats Ole Miss to end the year, it's a top 10 team. It is entirely possible that Alabama ends up losing to the highest ranked team on their schedule to end the season. But because of how quickly we dumped on them due to their poor performance early, I think this was more an unranked team because they were in a massive slump, not an unranked team in terms of quality. And it's maybe the ranking number that was wrong here more than the streak being broken.
All right, y'all, that's it for our recap on this. Let us know in the comments what you thought about this game, what you think about the outlook for these two teams. And remember, our live show, great discussion. I think y'all would love it. Check it out in the description on our YouTube channel. Thanks so much, y'all. Have a great week. God bless. We'll